You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democrats in the House of Representatives passed a bill last week that would restore so-called net neutrality rules, but that legislation faces an uphill battle in the Senate. We'll learn more about the bill and why net neutrality could be a platform for Democrats in 2020. Now, Milwaukee County officials proclaim that racism is a public health crisis in that community. This is building on a commitment by the Wisconsin Public Health Association to build racial equity in health and healthcare and to support efforts that are meant to achieve that goal. In the press release, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley said, quote, "It is Milwaukee County's responsibility to address racism, including seeking solutions to reshape the discourse, actively engaging all citizens in racial justice work. Local government needs to take a leadership role, and we intend to do so," end quote. Chandra Ford is an associate professor of community health sciences and founding director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health in the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. She studies the impact of racism on health and the way healthcare is provided. Chandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, big picture, what do we know about how the health of people of color compares with that of white Americans?
In general, regardless of the health outcome that you're looking at, or the healthcare-related factor that you're considering, we tend to see that people of color, in particular African Americans and Latinos, have poorer health outcomes than do whites.
And with this proclamation from Milwaukee County saying that racism is a public health crisis, connect the dots for us. How do you see racism affecting these health outcomes you just described?
Well, over the last two decades, researchers have been studying racism quite a bit. This is an area of study that's garnered quite a bit of empirical focus over the last couple of decades. And what excites me about what's happening there in Milwaukee is this aligns very well with what the flagship Professional Society for Public Health folks has already called for. Nearly 2 years ago, the American Public Health Association recognized that racism is an issue that hampers the well-being of the entire society by sapping the resources of the entire society because a significant chunk of our population is not achieving optimal health for reasons that are preventable. What we know is that one of the main concerns that people are raising now has to do with the overt forms of racism, so things like white supremacist marches. But really, it's the day-to-day wear and tear of the disrespect, or even at the structural level, things like segregation, that has the greatest impact on the most number of people of color.
Right. I wanted to talk about the term racism. It gets used in a lot of different ways, but I think there are two that kind of talk past each other sometimes. I think popularly people think of racism as an individual thing. One person exhibits racial bias to another person. You mentioned structural racism. Can you talk about that more and how it plays out, especially with the health world?
What a great point you're making there. So when we use the term racism, we're really talking about all the structures and mechanisms by which we systematically provide poor quality services and care to one group versus another group. And when we look at the data, the groups align along racial lines. So the poor quality of care is not randomly assigned to different groups. It's pretty consistently that people of color receive poorer care or have poorer outcomes. And so that's what we're focused on. We do assess, and there is an impact of this interpersonal racism. For instance, if I'm called a name or I experience something that feels stressful or it's offensive to me, there is an impact of that. But the greater impact is, for instance, living in a segregated neighborhood. I like to use the example of if an environmental hazard is placed in a poor community, in a community of color, by definition, children who grow up in that neighborhood through no fault of their own are at increased risk of certain hazards. And at the same time, white children growing up away from that hazard, and they're growing up, by definition, if it's in the minority community, is by definition, not in the majority community, they're growing up with a certain advantage, a certain health advantage that comes from, that's actually very closely tied to the health disadvantage that the minority children will face.
Talking to Chandra Ford from the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health about the impacts of race and racism on health, healthcare, and health outcomes. And Chandra, let's start to pick apart some of these different things. You mentioned environmental factors. An issue in Milwaukee County and other communities around the country is exposure to lead, from lead paint in older buildings, lead water intakes, often in older buildings. Is this something that nationwide tends to be concentrated in places where people of color now live?
You know, an extensive assessment of exactly where all of the lead is located is really needed. But what we know so far is that children of color are overexposed to lead in paints through some of the kinds of segregation that we think of as what we might call centralization. That is, living in the center parts of cities where the infrastructure is really poor and it's really old rusted pipes, old paint, and those kinds of things where the hazards have not actually been taken care of.
And let's talk about healthcare access. What kind of differences do we see when it comes to just sheer having the ability to have a doctor's visit or a specialist visit when it comes to race?
So these are very complex because the relationship between race, ethnicity, and what we will call socioeconomic factors like income and education are really complex. Regardless of the level of education that people have, the buying power of that education is lower for blacks versus whites, for instance. And so with access to healthcare, we see a similar pattern where we already know that, based in part because of the socioeconomic patterns, that blacks and Latinos in particular and American Indians have poorer access to healthcare services in general. However, I do think it's also important to point out that even if we only looked at people who do have good access to care across race and ethnicity, that we still do see disparities occurring within the context of care. So that is something that we might be able to target within the healthcare system. How can we get providers to better recognize the ways in which the healthcare systems and individual healthcare providers might actually contribute to differential treatment that patients get?
Yeah, what might that look like on the ground in a doctor's office or clinic? What kind of differential treatment are we seeing by race in those healthcare situations?
Mm-hmm. So one example is a study conducted by one of the affiliates of my center and a colleague here at UCLA, Billy Cunningham, and his several of other physicians, where they observed that this is all among HIV patients, and they observed that those patients who were seen by white providers had differences in how long it took them to get prescribed HIV medications depending on the patient's race. Now, the same pattern did not exist for patients who were seen by black providers, black doctors. That is, patients, whether they were white or black, who were seen by a black doctor all got their HIV medications around the same point in their course of disease. But for black patients, being seen by a white provider actually predicted that they would receive their prescription to these vital medications later in the course of disease than their white counterparts.
How do you tackle that? Is this a case where we're thinking these white doctors were consciously biasing their treatment toward one patient and against another, or are there unspoken, maybe unexamined assumptions that might lead them to treat patients differently? How do we sort that out?
This is a tremendous area of interest of mine and you know, a growing area for the field. What we do know is that culture matters. Things like culture and being able to communicate effectively with one another matter, but that's not everything. there is a growing literature on implicit bias, which means that the forms of racism that are enacted are forms that the actor is actually not aware of. And what's important to keep in mind about implicit bias, and there are two points here. One is that they're not just arbitrary. It's not just that, oh, I as an individual like apples and that other individual likes oranges. The biases that we hold are actually structured by the institutions and the society that we live in, so they're shaped and they're very predictable. The other thing is that implicit bias matters a lot when we're talking about disciplines and people who are progressive identified. So it's really that it's not saying that overt racism doesn't happen, but it points out that there are people for whom implicit forms of racism are particularly salient. And those of us who believe and who really espouse equity and fairness are actually more susceptible to not knowing when we're engaging in racist acts or acts that contribute to disparities, in part because we're blinded to the ways that our own embrace of our own progressiveness can blind us to the ways that we're actually participating in creating those disparities. So one example of a possible solution might come from another recent study that looked at how having an automated system that provides cues to providers to just remember to check this patient's, each particular aspect of the care visit. The computer provides automated information for the provider. So the provider doesn't spend a lot of time trying to decide, is this a patient that should receive this treatment or not? They rely on an exchange system that can help them to be more systematic about every patient. And thus it takes away that sort of the gray area that comes into play. And that it's really taking away that gray area, that indecision, that element that involves trying to decide between X and Y for any given patient, that's where we see the big issue with bias creeping in.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Milwaukee County declaring racism to be a public health crisis. Chandra Ford is Associate Professor of Community Health Services and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as a patient or a healthcare provider. Do you see different treatments, different outcomes, different attitudes toward people of different races in that clinical setting? On a bigger picture, what do you think of how the places people live, the impacts of segregation have affected health over time? And if you have a question for our guest, call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Chandra, before we go to a caller, let's talk about solutions. As you look at a place like Milwaukee County trying to tackle this issue head on, what kind of things do you think they should start with?
You know, I think the first step has already been taken, and that is to acknowledge that there is a problem with racism. That's really just acknowledging that racism exists and that it affects us is a huge first step. And so I congratulate the folks in Milwaukee for doing that. The other thing is it's important to try to get as many diverse folks and diverse segments of the community involved in this effort. Everyone brings different perspectives to the problem. There are many ways in which racism affects folks, and unless all those different voices are heard, we won't really be able to get at the root of the problem. The National Academies in 2017 also published an extensive study in which they recommended that trying to get the buy-in even of the local private sector is important. And you can see how the involvement of the private sector might be very different from the interests of, for instance, community organizers who are concerned with what they see every day in the lives of the community members that they with whom they live and whom they love.
Let's bring on a caller now. Denise is with us in Viroqua. Denise, hi.
Hello, and thanks for having this conversation. I am white, and my husband is black. And every time we go to the doctor, he wants me to go with. And it is extremely painful and awkward experience because the doctors don't talk to him. They talk to me. And it's hard because he does not want to go to the doctor. He hates going. And all we hope is that nothing really bad happens. And I'm just so thankful that you're looking into this as a serious health issue in our community.
Denise, thanks for the call. What an experience. Chandra, is there? Do you see this problem being big enough that, as Denise is saying, someone like her husband is skeptical of the kind of care he's going to get because he's black?
That's actually not unusual at all. In a lot of my work around HIV testing and HIV care, we've found that at least 20% of African Americans may actually hold beliefs that HIV, the HIV epidemic, might be a conspiracy to try to get rid of African-American and other quote-unquote undesirable populations. One way to think about that is, oh my goodness, why do they have those extreme ideas? But the other way to think about it is these folks experience the healthcare system in a way that allows those beliefs to seem realistic and plausible. And so it's a real sign that there is something going on in the healthcare system that makes many folks feel uncomfortable. And part of it is things that have happened in the past, but still today, people, African Americans and others, experience the healthcare system in a way that makes them feel very uncomfortable trusting it.
Denise, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Tekla in Beaver Dam. Tekla, hi.
Hi, how are you? This is a great topic. My husband is a non-native English speaker, and one of the problems with the healthcare system in general is the inability to communicate effectively with people who are non-English speakers. And we have encountered a variety of issues. The best, of course, is an in-person translator. But even in that case, that translator may not be translating really what the doctor's saying. They're supposed to say word for word back and forth, but a lot of them, especially late in the afternoon, you know, are cutting it short or missing vital information. We've had some situations at certain facilities, they have signs up, if you need to speak in another language, let us know, and it's in, you know, Spanish and Hmong and China, you know, other languages, and then you request a translator and you don't get one.
Tekla, thanks for sharing that story. Chandra, is that something you've looked into, the impact of language gaps in healthcare outcomes?
Yes, that's one of the areas that researchers have examined, and those examples are just unfortunate and unfortunately actually quite common. I think this is an area where the healthcare field can really make a huge impact, and in part it might be a question of commitment. These would require dollars and investments in things like training, perhaps training providers to speak the languages, as well as investing in translators, so or in interpreters. So that's a very concrete, tangible area for improvement that could affect not only the professionalism with which care is delivered, but also the perceptions that patients walk away from the clinical encounter with.
Tekla, thanks for that call. Chandra, in our last couple minutes, can you talk to maybe administrators, healthcare providers? What kind of things should they be watching for to make sure that they get the best healthcare outcomes for their non-white patients, and to make sure that, unlike our earlier caller, that those patients feel comfortable coming in and coming to that visit?
I think one of the most important things is to actually, as researchers would say, measure it. So we get patient satisfaction surveys from our providers sometimes. Are there questions on those surveys that allow patients to talk about these kinds of experiences, not necessarily as a way to point their fingers at particular individuals, but really to show providers exactly where the kinks are in the delivery of care. I think that is a very important first step. And then I think it's also important for providers as well as white folks or other folks in majority positions to realize that in talking about racism, it's really not about the dominant group in terms of just pointing a finger. It's really about addressing the problem for the benefit of the entire community. And so I would really urge everyone to become involved in finding the solutions and not to get caught up thinking about what does this mean about me? So that's one of the concerns that I've heard expressed in some of the qualitative work that I've done. And I think that that's something that can be overcome and that it would help the full community to feel committed to this as a community-wide endeavor.
Chandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Chandra Ford is Associate Professor of Community Health Sciences and Founding Director of the Center for the Study of Racism, Social Justice, and Health at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. She joined us to talk about Milwaukee County's declaration of racism as a public health crisis. Coming up, we'll talk about the latest political fight over the rules that govern the Internet. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin Congressional Representative Mark Pocan joins Kate Archer-Kent for a look at immigration and sanctuary cities, along with other top issues facing Congress. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Democrats in the House of Representatives passed a bill last week that would restore Obama-era rules governing how telecommunications companies provide access to the Internet. These net neutrality rules aim to even the playing field for Internet users and prevent Internet service providers from creating fast or slow lanes for websites that can afford to pay more for traffic directed to their sites. But the bill that passed in the House is unlikely to pass in the Republican-controlled Senate, and some Democrats have seen the issue of net neutrality as a potential platform to gain votes in 2020. John Hendel is a technology reporter for Politico. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, can you outline what this bill that passed the House would do if it somehow passed the Senate and got signed by the president?
Right. This bill is called the Save the Internet Act. And what it would do specifically is bring back the repealed 2015 Obama-era net neutrality rules. Those rules specifically would prevent a big telecommunications company like AT&T or Comcast or Charter from controlling where you're going online and how. Essentially, they would stop these companies from blocking or throttling any consumer's internet traffic and kind of prevent any internet fast lanes or slow lanes. So that, you know, would just reinstate those rules as they were drafted in 2015. They were in effect for about a couple of years, and then the FCC at the end of 2017 repealed those rules. And it's been a huge Democratic priority item really for many, many years now. And last week's vote was a big example of just kind of how excited they were and how central they see this to their tech agenda going forward.
Now, the key on this back and forth is that Congress really hasn't done a thing here on this issue, so that it's up to the FCC to set the policy. And that can change because the president picks who the FCC is, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the president nominates the different commissioners of the FCC, and his party or her party controls kind of who leads at the FCC. So you have sometimes a bit of what's referred to as a ping pong effect, where if you have a Democratic administration, you know, you have a Democratic-led FCC that might be passing certain tough net neutrality regulations that Republicans would see as maybe a little bit less business friendly. And that's kind of what we've seen happen here, where under President Obama's administration and under his FCC picks, you had these strong rules that Republicans opposed from the get-go and saw as kind of government, you know, heavy-handed regulation that, you know, they would point to as dangerous. You know, they kept looking at different side effects that could come from that, such as, you know, They kept fearing internet taxation and other things the Democrats said they had no interest in doing through these rules. But that was the clarion call you kind of kept hearing from Republicans for those years. And then, lo and behold, fast forward a couple of years, you have, you know, the Trump-appointed FCC immediately kind of moving to, you know, take comment and repeal those rules early on in this last administration. And yeah, Congress, meanwhile, hasn't been able to act on this at all. I mean, you've seen certain messaging bills make it through one chamber or another, but it's remained highly partisan with very little bipartisan dialogue on what a compromise bill would look like. I mean, there's been a few people saying they'd like that, but at the end of the day, not much real negotiation on what that would be, and certainly no markups or advancement of any real consensus legislation. It's been up in arms throughout.
And what one concern that's come up is the idea that, okay, without net neutrality, it can actually be anti-competitive for businesses. If my company controls the internet architecture and I want to promote my corporate partners, I can get them to consumers better. And my rivals to those partners, I can slow things down. So a new upstart company might have a harder time getting a foothold. Is that something that that people have argued?
You've been hearing that over and over. Yeah, that's very much a central part of Democrats' argument in kind of pushing for regulations like this. They say that to have these rules enshrined, whether it's at the FCC or in law, as this Save the Internet bill would do, they say that's crucial when it comes to small businesses, underrepresented communities, lots of different people who could be affected by, you know, a big corporation like AT&T or Comcast. You know, they say these rules are just critical for that reason. Republicans, they would counter that you don't need rules in the way that are acted like this to actually protect consumers. They say, you know, we're going to keep a tiny portion of the old rules. I mean, they've kept a transparency requirement at the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, where companies essentially have to say, this is how we're managing our network. These are our practices on that. And then, you know, the argument is that the Federal Trade Commission could jump in and actually help prevent any harms were there to be anti-competitive practices or problems or things along those lines. So, I mean, that's been the argument. Republicans are quick to say that they want consumers protected, that they care about net neutrality, and they'll even say that they're fine with those main rules that I described before, you know, rules to prevent a big internet provider from blocking or throttling your traffic. They say they're fine with that. Their concern is all about kind of how these rules were drafted. They say they're part of an old part of telecom law that, you know, was really meant for the Ma Bell like era monopoly phone system. That's what they'll kind of point to, even though, you know, Democrats, when drafting these rules and drafting this bill, you know, they'll say like, oh, we've prevented a lot of the archaic parts of that. Republicans still say, no, this raises the specter of rate regulation and kind of big government jumping into that. And that's what you kept hearing from Republicans on the House floor last week and in the committees before that, over and over, this refrain of this could lead to government taxation of the internet. This could lead to control in a way that, you know, we're not comfortable with. But Democrats would be the first to tell you they don't see their rules that way at all, and that it is critical for the average consumer out there who's just trying to get around on the internet.
Talking to John Hendel, technology reporter for Politico, looking at the net neutrality debate. The U.S. House passed a net neutrality law reinstating Obama-era FCC guidelines in effect. I want to take a listen to some of what you were just talking about there, starting with Republican Representative Bill Johnson from Ohio.
The digital divide is very real, and we have a responsibility to provide solutions, not create additional barriers to deployment, growth, and innovation. Rural communities don't need or want higher costs and fewer options than they already have. And that's why I oppose this legislation. As I've stated before, the only saving the internet needs is from heavy-handed Washington regulations.
Again, Representative Bill Johnson, Republican from Ohio there. That concern that, okay, net neutrality regulations are going to raise costs has come up before. Do we have any data? We've had it for a while. We didn't for a while. Do we know if it has an impact?
That's been one of the most heavily debated parts of this whole discussion. And there's been arguments on both sides in terms of that, where, you know, you've seen dips in investment here and there when the rules were in effect. But honestly, it's so brief a window. It's been kind of hard for either side to grapple onto any hard data. You do have some opponents of these rules who will say, like, that investment dipped a little bit over those 2 years, but, you know, initially it didn't seem like it did at all. And you have many different net neutrality advocates pointing to the fact that these companies seem to be doing just fine. And again, making bigger deals too. I mean, a company like AT&T immediately moved and pledged billions of dollars to buy Time Warner right in the midst of when these rules were kind of going into effect. So, you know, I think that there's no decisive set of data about just what those did to investment, but that's something that Republicans have glommed onto. You heard that with Congressman Johnson there, really emphasizing that as a concern. But even when the rules first went into effect, there was no immediate drop back after the 2015 order came out. And that was something Republicans had to grapple with at the time. I remember one of the top Republicans on Capitol Hill, Congressman Greg Walden of Oregon, you know, kind of noting, you know, like, oh, we're not going to see like a big actual drop because these companies are so big. They're just going to shift around how they invest. So the companies themselves seem to be doing fine, but that has been one of the big concerns and one of the big kind of drivers of Republican opposition to this. Just the idea that this could chill investment, chill the markets in a way, and ultimately hurt consumers. I mean, that's what they would argue there and what you saw on the floor from opponents of this bill and why you had a virtually completely party line vote with the exception of one Republican who voted for it last week on the House floor, which, again, is part of why we're not going to really see anything moving forward in the Republican-controlled Senate.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the politics surrounding net neutrality with John Hendel, technology reporter for Politico. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think this bill we're talking about that passed in the House? Or do you support the idea of net neutrality, or do you have worries about how it would regulate the internet? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, we listen to a Republican in the House who is against this legislation. Let's give a listen to Democrat Anna Eshoo of California.
Across America, 86% of the American people, Democrats, Republicans, independents, support what we're doing. We want this for our constituents. We want the protection of consumers. We don't want any myths on the internet. It's as simple as that. Groups from A to Z, from the Catholic bishops to the American Library Association, support this.
And John, what have we seen when it comes to public opinion on net neutrality? Is she right? Is the public generally behind Democrats on this?
That's generally where the numbers have fallen, I would say. I think that you have seen millions of comments coming into the Federal Communications Commission, just expressing a real desire for some sort of protections. And people like the idea of net neutrality. I mean, that's, I think, something we've seen, you know, in a tremendous way over the last 2 years, just the scale at which people will say they want protections, they want a free and open internet. It really gets trickier when you start drilling down into what that looks like. I mean, that's when you see big, you know, business institutions like the Chamber of Commerce jumping into the debate and saying, this is why we don't want these specific rules here. But Democrats are betting and hoping that there is that grassroots energy driving them forward. They've mentioned that as a key factor behind this bill. That's something that Congressman Mike Doyle, Democrat from Pennsylvania, who sponsored it, he brought up when I talked to him earlier this year, saying this was a campaign promise we really made throughout the midterms. This is why we're doing it. This is why Speaker Nancy Pelosi is getting it on the floor. And they really do, I think, see it that way. They think it's something that voters really care about and that will ultimately be a progressive agenda item that will, you know, fit really well with, you know, other Democratic platforms going into 2020. I mean, I think that's increasingly where the party has been, and that's partly why it's been as tense of an issue as it's become over the last couple of years. Again, even though everyone says they like net neutrality, whether they're Republican or Democrat on Capitol Hill, they do define it very differently. And this bill represents one particular type that the Democratic Party is coalesced around, but, you know, you're just not seeing consensus on it in any way where a bill is likely to move, at least anytime soon, absent some bigger X factor that drives things forward.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. Great topic. Part of the telecommunications world. I think that the only thing I have a problem with the Democrats on this part is that I think that they branded this with fear in the beginning because there's absolutely no proof. Nobody's complaining website-wise or business-wise that they're being throttled or blocked or anything at this time. And so, granted, we don't want to have things start happening, but given the fact that generally we're a reactionary people, we're a reactionary Congress, getting in front of this just seems to be adding regulations, which ultimately cost, because it costs in people having to look at it, people having to review it, and all these costs will be passed on to the consumer, whether it's us in taxes or whether it's AT&T or Verizon or whoever passing on in their bills. So ultimately, there is a cost to net neutrality when there's no smoke, there's no fire.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. That's a common argument, John. They have the opportunity, these companies, to do the things Democrats are worried about, and they're not doing them for the most part.
Right, and that's been a really interesting part of this, and that's something that Republicans have pointed to when questioning how salient this issue will be at the ballot box. I mean, Senator John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, a pretty high-ranking Republican, I remember asking him about whether this was going to become a big issue for voters over a year ago. I think I talked to him, you know, before the 2018 midterms, kind of early on in 2018. And the way he framed it was he doesn't really think voters are going to be too worried unless they see problems with their Netflix working, essentially. You know, that as long as people's internet is working fine and, you know, they're getting along to where they need to be online, that it's okay. So, I mean, you do see that. There's been isolated incidents in the past that suggest that companies would have the incentive to act in some of these ways. I mean, you know, if you go back in the net neutrality debate to, you know, the previous decade, you know, Comcast was taking action against BitTorrent, for instance. I mean, that was something that initially kind of ignited these discussions about, do we need regulation? What is the right set of rules for that? So you've seen a couple different things that suggest that in the past. It's not that nothing's ever happened, but these companies have been terrified of rules in lots of ways for years. And so they have been publicly pledging. They have no interest in blocking or throttling because they know how consumers would react. And that would change the debate in a pretty big way if you suddenly found, you know, AT&T, you know, going around immediately interfering with a lot of their customers' experiences. So you do have a couple things in the past, but that is one of the things that makes it maybe less visceral for a lot of voters and just people thinking about this issue out there, because they're not seeing, you know, the effects of a company acting this way and hurting their experience for the most part. There are different instances you can point to.
Mike, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Gwen with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. My question is, when you are looking at net neutrality and internet providers, and people are saying, well, if you regulate things, then there's no benefit to a corporation in expanding into rural areas, why can't they just allow the municipalities to be internet providers for those areas? Governments all need to have internet access. And, you know, if it was provided the same way a public utility would be, then, you know, their people could be benefiting from it, and it wouldn't matter because the big internet providers don't want to go in that area to provide services anyway.
Gwen, thanks a lot for the call, John. Yeah, this is something we hear a lot. Not a lot of options in rural Wisconsin, probably other places as well for internet. Is this an issue that comes up as part of this debate, the idea of municipal or governments becoming their own internet service providers, as Gwen is talking about?
Absolutely. And you have seen local governments trying to form their own networks sometimes. I mean, that's happened in many different parts of the country. And that's been a little bit controversial in its own right. It's something that a lot of different municipal officials are excited for, and for good reason. I mean, one of the biggest, you know, truly bipartisan causes that unites a lot of folks is the digital divide. The fact that, you know, in rural areas, people are struggling to get enough connectivity to do basic things that are required, you know, whether it's, you know, homework to job applications to anything else. I mean, that's a real frustration that a lot of people have. And so that has driven communities, local governments, to form their own networks. But that, again, gets into the debate of, is this the best way to truly kind of expand it? A lot of folks who push for that option would say that these companies aren't building out anyway, so of course they should. But you do see hesitation from bigger companies and others who will quickly say that, no, this isn't how you really expand it. This ends up putting government in a position where they're competing with these companies too, which they don't like. And you've seen a lot of lobbying on the state level about this, actually. You've seen some states passing prohibitions that really prevent local governments from getting involved in this business because they, you know, think that local governments don't know what they're doing and that it's a boondoggle. And, you know, you see rhetoric like that kind of applied to it in that case. But, you know, the point couldn't be stronger that there is a real frustration in getting broadband service out to a lot of these rural areas. And so one way or another, there is a big conversation going on about the best way to do that and what government funds might be needed to help these companies do it or help local governments themselves. Certainly public-private partnerships have also gotten a lot of attention too as one way to try to tackle that. But across the board, that's recognized as a bigger concern there. So that's a great point. I think that is part of the conversation.
Well, thanks for the call. And in just our last few moments, John, probably nothing is going to get passed on net neutrality between now and Election Day 2020. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say right now, but there are those X factors I alluded to. I mean, as it stands at this very moment, you've got, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell calling this bill dead on arrival in the Senate, and many Republicans that don't seem to have any desire to kind of touch the underlying substance of what House Democrats just passed. However, the thing I'd flag that could shift things a little bit is that you also have a legal challenge going on right now in the court system. After the FCC in 2017, under Republican FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, after they repealed the rules from the Obama administration, there was a big legal challenge. A lot of net neutrality advocates in Mozilla and others did challenge that in the court. And if they are victorious, if they essentially repeal the repeal of these FCC net neutrality rules, then that could change the debate on Capitol Hill. That's the one thing that I would kind of wonder about, because if you suddenly had the rules springing back into effect thanks to a court ruling, you know, maybe that would change the appetite for negotiation among Republicans.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to John Hendel from Politico talking about the latest politics of net neutrality.